What's happening in the canine industry? For all the latest news, views, and expert opinions, stay right here for the Canine Paradigm. You'll hear from industry leaders, experts, doyens of the industry, learned colleagues, movers and shakers, and the odd randy guest. Get the latest insights and expert advice from both here and abroad from the people in the know. Now, here are your hosts, Glenn Cook and Pat Stewart. And I'm Lofty Fulton, and I'm out of here.
Hey, I need to tell you something.
Oh, God, what is it?
Some time ago, we did an ad episode where we talked about how we were going to get better with our ads.
I was wondering where you were going. Yeah. We're so shit at the ads. That's what we said.
We said, we're so shit, we're going to get better, and we just didn't.
We don't. We're so full of shit.
All right, well, here they are. We got five sponsors currently.
All right, who are they?
First is the OG. The Ian's a wiener.
Oh, that knob.
The buffhead.
Yeah.
Nah, he's the OG. He's been with us
he's
since
good.
The start.
No, he's good.
He's going to sell you whatever you need.
Yeah.
He'll get it. What you should do is contact Jason from Ainswick Dog Quip with some peculiar product, tell him you want it, and make him get it in and sell it to you. Even if you could buy it somewhere else, just make sure he gets it in for you.
Just make that bastard work.
But in all honesty, I'd say 90% of my shit comes from him, and it's all the best stuff.
I did see some feedback on our forum where somebody was really intrigued about your handler package, the one that you got from Jason. Obviously, it works.
Yeah,
like people are paying attention to the ads. That's great. Even though we're shit at this, we do a terrible job of actually trying to keep things updated. It's great to see that the people who are investing in our show are actually getting some leeway.
Yep. Mate, I've heard that your wife sells some canine products.
My wife is doing great guns at the moment. I said before that she's been supported terrifically in the United States, which has been good. But I will swing that back home and say that so many more people in Australia are doing it. And it's great to see, like, there are people finally in the sporting dog world who are starting to prioritize nutrition for their dogs. And I know them. I can see them when Narelle comes in and says, oh, guess who bought some product off me for the first time.
So are you saying there's no patient confidentiality?
No, there's patient confidentiality.
Oh, sorry.
It's just a mailing list.
Confidentiality.
Well, it's a mailing list.
Are you aware my dog is taking pee? Collagen and what's the other thing he takes?
Antinol.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been on that.
Antinol is not Narelle's business, but I've got to do a shout out for Antinol. They are absolutely fantastic. They're very supportive of our show.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we've done seminars and so forth, they have been first to dip their hand in their pocket. They are very generous with their product. But let me just say, all that aside, their generosity and their advertising and marketing, let me just say on the other side of that, their product is amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it does work. It's very beneficial.
For sure.
It's one of those things where they say Antinol for every dog every day. I totally agree with that. Narelle has even supported that. When people have asked them about her product, she says the two things that I would absolutely give to you is Antinol and her Gut Protect formula.
Yeah, right.
Gut Protect is like her holy grail of her whole range.
Flagship of the range.
This is not me market talking, okay?
Because we are. This is an ad.
This is an ad, but this is not me doing marketing.
But we've already pointed out we're shit at ads.
I know. Of all the things that she sells, and she sells some killer product, but the one thing that she does sell, which I absolutely agree with her, every dog should have this product, is the Gut Protect.
Really?
100%. It's nothing that they need for being sick. It's something that they need to do just to maintain great gut balance.
Okay.
And gut balance is like mental health. It's one of those things that you absolutely want to get control around. So products like Antinol, great for every day. Gut Protect, great for every day. There's other products that aren't even related to hers called things like Rosehip Vital and stuff like that. Absolutely fantastic for dogs to be on every sort of day.
Mm.
But I know there's other people we need to talk about. If you want to learn more about Narelle's products, go to our website, canineceuticals.com. I think it's
dot, I think it's dot, you'll figure it out.
It's .com or .com.au. It's one of those.
No one types that shit anyway. Everyone just Googles it. And
yeah,
then goes,
just Google it. You'll find it.
Hey.
Yeah.
George Kittredge. I reckon we should get him on the show.
We should have George Kittredge on the show. Yeah. Not only is he devilishly handsome, but he's got a fantastic, one-of-a-kind product that I've never seen replicated anywhere in the world. You and me were getting a car ride by him. We got to see the prototype firsthand. Yep.
And then his bike got stolen with the prototype on it.
It did.
Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, George has Rowdy Hound Dog Box. And so it's a crate that goes on the back of your motorbike so that your dog can go everywhere with you.
Yeah.
And it's cool as shit. It's a great idea. You should totally get one. Taylor Canines in Canada.
Yeah.
Do you know that Taylor from Taylor Canines is hosting Jazz Whiting later in the year?
I do know that. Yes. I saw the ad. Very good.
Yep.
Not only is she doing great stuff with her tailored canine.
Her training business,
but she's also getting a fantastic trainer over there to help with her tailored training.
She is. And finally, Barbara DeGroote
The sugar mama from the Heart Dog Training. Just fucking throws cash at us.
Just supports the show. God bless
her. Yeah. I think later on the year when Narelle and I are over doing a seminar with Melanie Benway, Barbara DeGroote is coming over.
Wonderful.
I think she has put down a like, and I said, you better come, sugar mama, and she gave me a thumbs up. So hopefully she's going to be there and I can give her some love to repay us for all the kindness and support that she's thrown at us and asked nothing in return.
All right. That's our ad.
Yeah.
That one's good to go for at least another 4 years. You'll hear from us then. Welcome back to the Canine Paradigm. I'm your host, Pat Stewart. I'm joined by my co-host, Glenn Cook.
Hello again, sir, for another episode.
How are you?
I'm good.
It's a day after Anzac Day. I'm slightly hungover.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
It's not too bad. It's mostly in the body and it's mostly from sugar. I didn't drink that much alcohol, but it's all the sugar in those drinks. I feel like shit. But we continue.
So what happens on Anzac Day? Like, give us the cliff notes for you.
For me, like, you know, most people do like a dawn service. At the moment, because I've got young kids, I don't go to the dawn service. I used to go to the dawn service like at my old unit because they're the names of people I know who mm-hmm. were killed in action. So rather than going to just a local one. But at the moment, I don't go to that. I just go straight to the commando memorial. So that one's at 8 o'clock and it's easier with kids and more, much more capable. And that's the memorial for special forces, essentially. And so we go to that one. And most of the units there. And then we go out to breakfast with a bunch of the guys that I actually went through with. And then we sort of watch part of the march and then hang out with the rest of the unit at various bars throughout the city. So it's just a big catch-up day. Like there's, you know, there's the memorial in the morning. It's very important. We see part of the march and stuff. But then for me, it's more of a like, hey, catching up with all army people and seeing where things are at and just staying in the loop with all these people. And you do that. You'd have the same conversation 100 times during the day. Like, well, what do you do now? And then people are like, oh, I do this now. It's the same thing. What's weird is that a lot of the guys who, you know, I was in with like follow me online. And so they kind of know what I'm up to, you know, like yeah. they sort of, and I'm really well supported by the guys in the unit. Like a lot of people, yeah, everybody likes to see people doing well and stuff like that. And so like guys follow me and see what I'm up to. And so it was really cool, like to get that feedback from guys who I don't see very often. And you see different people on different Anzac days, you know, because people move around. So you don't see the same guys every year. So it's good to see people that, you know, I haven't seen in 4 or 5 years and just kind of catch up with it. It's a fun day, but it's hard work on the body.
Absolutely. I don't really do many reunion-ish type of things. I catch up with people that I've used to have involvement with certain things. I'm a bit of a lone wolf with that sort of stuff. Prior to going to air, I was telling you that there's sometimes my arm's been twisted to go along to reunion things like school reunions and things in the past. And I've kind of thought, oh, now I know why I don't like going to reunions. But it would be a little bit different, you know, sharing those life and death encounters with your army family. That's pretty intimate. There's a lot of things there that you're really relying on each other to save each other's lives in certain situations. So for that, it's unimaginable to me how different that would be.
What happens for sure, like in my old unit, is you get these very intense and quite short-term relationships with people. Mm. So everybody kind of knows each other in the unit, but then, you know, you and three guys might be put together to go and run a training team somewhere. So you all end up like you've known these people, you work with them in the greater unit, but there's, you know, hundreds of people in the unit. But then the three or four of you will live together for 6 months and you'll have these really intense experiences together. You have to work with each other, you know, basically living in each other's pockets for 6 months. And then when you return from that trip, you just sort of go back to your normal places in the unit and don't see those people so much anymore. So you have these quite short-term, very intense relationships. On those kind of days, you sort of catch up with people and it's like, oh, remember we spent 3 months living in that tent in wherever together. And you sort of have that time with these guys and you sort of reminisce a little bit. And then it's like, all right, well, fucking see you in a few years. You know what I mean? Like it's, so it's, they're weird little catch-ups, that's for sure.
Those sort of things are, as I said before, it's unimaginable to a lot of people who aren't in agency groups where that's required, where you've got to bunk out with people. And like I said, you know, there'd be situations where you'd be going on missions and literally saving each other's lives or being involved in some very emotionally challenging situations. My grandfather was involved in World War II. He was a sergeant in the Air Force and didn't speak a lot about his time. He told me periodic stories here and there about being involved in some of the Middle Eastern deserts and Rommel's battalion chasing him through Libya or areas like that. And it was pretty hair-raising. But for him, it was just not really something he enjoyed talking about. He had to do it. I think he was there for 6 or 7 years or something like that. It was a long occupation. And I do remember one day we were sitting there having a chat, and he was saying that there were a group of his mates that he was playing cards with in a tent, and he went off to the latrine or whatever. I think he just wandered off to the desert to go to the toilet. There was a strike that night. The tent that he was in was incinerated. There were two times in my timeline that I almost wasn't here, and that was one of them for one grandfather who was involved in that side. My other grandfather, my Dutch grandfather, he was imprisoned in a prisoner of war camp by the Germans. He was the barber for a lot of the people in the camp and also the officers. And his mate, who was the cook, one night nicked a loaf of bread and he brought it back and he divided it up between my grandfather himself and their other mate. So there were three of them in this group. My grandfather said he was hungry that night. He said, "I'm a greedy bastard." And he said, "And I ate my bread and didn't leave a crumb there." And he said, "At 3 o'clock in the morning, the Germans came in. They raided the barracks where we were, the bunks where we were." And he said, "They searched high and low." He said, "They found some of the bread under the cook's pillow. They found some of the bread under my friend's pillow." And he said, "In the morning, those two guys were hung." And he said, "Because I ate mine, I was a greedy bastard. They didn't find anything." So there were two times where my timeline could have vanished on those two occasions. One with my grandfather who walked out of a tent and it was incinerated, and the other one where my grandfather was almost hung for accepting stolen goods in a prisoner of war camp. So amazing how things turn out. Like, they were literally times which could have prevented me from being in existence. So when you look at how precious your life is and those close calls where you almost weren't meant to be, it's just amazing that you defied the odds, and then that one sperm out of all those millions of sperms made you. So it's an incredible thing how life just turns out to be how it is.
Well, we've got more questions here.
Let's do that.
All right. So this one's from Gavin, says, related to the discussion in the most recent podcast, drive channeling and capping, and awareness that drives are innate and can be accessed via play, including tug, chasing a ball, pursuing food, etc. Question relates to restarting these pathways in dogs where it has, in essence, been suppressed for long periods of time. Specifically, seeing a number of pet dogs recently, young adults and some slightly older, that have come out of rescues and while otherwise appear to be happy in their new environment, show little interest in what would be expected to be seen from a dog when a toy item comes out and starts to move around in play. And the dog shows absolutely zero interest in chasing or engaging with the toy at all, often resulting in arousal that the dog channels into something undesirable instead of towards what is desirable, the toy, the game. So the question, when drives have been suppressed for long periods or never developed in younger years, is it possible to reignite those drives, which should be innate? Which is the best approach to that? And are there dangers or pitfalls to be aware of and avoided?
My understanding and my knowledge to that is, yes, suppression will damage the future of some drives. It's the same thing with developing socialization. So think about it on the same sort of curvature. If a puppy or even a human is not adequately socialized, or when we start talking about the developmental stages of drive or the suppression of drives, it has a parallel existence with the two of them. To my knowledge, a dog that has been suppressed in drives from a young age or even throughout some adult years, if the dog believes that I'm not supposed to do this, that there is punishment involved in it, or there's no knowledge of doing it, it's been reduced, it's been punished away, or it's even being conditioned away from the dog, the time that you want it to resurface, the dog will find it difficult to understand what it was supposed to do. And then the other side of that is that the ceiling will be considerably reduced on the drives that you want the dog to express, because it was never allowed to openly flourish as a young dog, juvenile or young adult into what it possibly could have been. So think about those drives and socialization capabilities on a similar parallel pathway. Is if the ceiling is somehow reduced, that's what you've got left to work with. To think on the question a little bit more, the pitfalls, the problems, the issues that could surround that when you're trying to reignite those drives is frustration, lack of awareness, possibly even redirection, because the dog doesn't actively know how to channel it. It's never been allowed to prosper as a young dog, as a juvenile. It's never really been funneled into where it should go. Therefore, when the dog is expected to do these things, or the arousal of these drives is reignited in the dog, you'll see a diffusal rather than a focus on where that drive should actually go. Talented trainers and talented handlers, I've seen them do remarkable things where they've re-emerged drive from dogs before, where that drive has been somewhat dormant or suppressed in the dog. I've seen some incredible opportunities with some dogs. Well, I've done it myself. I know you've done it yourself. I've reawakened drives within dogs before, and I've brought them to the best capability. But if I'm analytical about it and I look at it from a holistic viewpoint, I know when I'm looking at the drives that have been reawakened in the dog that it's probably nowhere near as good as it could have been. It's just as good as it gets for now.
Yeah. It's probably good to give some specific examples. One of the things that we definitely see quite a bit is puppies who are just being puppies. They're running around chasing everything. They're biting people's ankles. They're doing whatever. And then people can suppress that drive pretty easily by an accidental even correction on a dog at that age can really cause an inhibition. And what I think I see is like also you can just get these things not develop. And something that I think is really important to remember is, you know, some dogs that sort of really high level of prey drive or the willingness to engage in the biting of a toy game, like that can come with some maturity as well. Like we see that in the development, you know, we're talking dogs in general, but we see that in the development when we're going to develop a sport dog or something like that, is that you sometimes get dogs that turn up and really don't have a lot of prey, like don't really have a lot of interest in chasing things that move and biting it. And then, you know, if you just keep giving them the opportunity to do it, keep developing it, it can come in. And sometimes you see that turn on and that can happen. You know, like you see that with working dogs, that can happen in a matter of days. A dog can go from not having really any interest in chasing a rag or something around to then really being obsessed with it. And that might happen, you know, like most notably, we got a dog in the club that went from that between 2 weeks, you know, like was absolutely not interested in chasing anything around. And then went to screaming, barking mad, doing it within a week later for the next training session. And that can happen, you know, as young as that was 13 weeks old with that dog. And then it can also end up with, you know, dogs that are 10 months old, stuff like that, like where those drives, the willingness, that prey drive, that is the drive that we'll use in order to play with the dog, not real prey as in like chasing something to run it down, kill it, and eat it. But like the way we're going to tap into prey drive to play a game of tug and stuff like that, like those innate drives can develop over literally years, you know. Sometimes dogs don't start expressing that until they're much older. So it's important to think sometimes as well, like we think that a dog has had its, like that drive suppressed, or it's easy for us again to make assumptions about, well, something's happened here, but it might just be that the dog just hasn't grown into that yet and just isn't interested in it yet. And normally you can kind of tell the difference between a dog that just isn't interested and a dog that's been corrected away from it, or those doors have been closed, is that there's a level of aversion that's there when it has been suppressed. There's telltale signs of suppression. You see it sometimes with people who have done exactly what we always say not to, by correcting a young dog for, you know, jumping up and pulling washing off the line. And then they end up in a sort of a game of tug of war with the dog and end up getting, you know, what the dog perceives as a harsh correction, closes the door on that. And then it can be really difficult. But those dogs are usually pretty easy to identify when they've got that issue, because they show like an impulse towards wanting to do it. And then the body language of suppression, where you can see they're making an active choice not to do something that they want to do, rather than just aren't quite into it yet. And my experience with getting dogs through that, like, you know, there's lots of different ways, but for the most part, what we want to do, like if a dog believes that it shouldn't do something that we now want it to do, sort of one of the ways to do it, I find, is that we got to sort of increase the level of arousal of the dog to the point where the dog wants to do it so badly that it still remembers there could be a consequence for this, that there could be a correction that comes if I do it. But at this stage, my desire to do it has reached such a level that I'm willing to accept that consequence. And then they do it, and then the consequence doesn't come. And that's the way to get them through it. If it were that, you know, this is where we sort of, you know, we put a dog on a back tie and we get the rag moving so erratically and so fast that it's really igniting that prey, and the dog sort of have to get spooled right up, gets really aroused, and then thinks, well, fuck it, I'm going to chase this thing. knowing this could result in a correction, but then obviously that correction doesn't happen because we're trying to cultivate that. And then the dog's like, right, okay, well, I did it and it didn't happen. Like, and now I can express myself like that. But in my experience, that usually kind of lingers. Like there is some sort of inhibition sort of forever, or there's a stress associated with it because it's like, how's this going to go for me? This has gone bad in the past. I really want to do it. I'm willing to accept a little bit of it going bad if it does again, but like there's still that looming threat. And I think that's where you get noisy grips and stuff like that, like where the dog is now stressed while it's doing it. So it's not getting to just do it freely, it's doing it under the looming threat of a penalty that could come for having done it, even though when we never intend to do that just because somebody else has done that in the past. So the answer to the question from my point of view is, can it be reignited? Like very often, yes, I think it can be, but you might have to get a bit creative in how you do that. I remember you've done it and you gave me the advice, Glenn, one time when I had a Roddy that just had plenty of prey, clearly had plenty of prey, but wouldn't engage in anything. Remember that? And so I had a dog that it clearly had been the same thing. And in fact, when I asked the owner, he confirmed that he had done all these things, like, you know, stopping the dog wrecking stuff because it was as a young puppy. That's
yeah,
you know,
I remember that conversation. Yep.
This dog had plenty of prey. Like he wanted to bite stuff and he's barking and lunging and jumping at things, but then just was not willing to put his teeth on it. Like just wasn't able to do it. And with your recommendation, we got the dog going. Like it never turned out to be a, you know, a high powered working dog, but we were able to get the dog going by playing with food and because it was willing to eat the food. And so I had a fucking stupid steak on the end, just like tied to a, like a flirt pole. It was basically doing flirt pole stuff with a piece of meat that it eventually like put its mouth on because it was going to eat it and then was able to keep that alive a little bit and then slip it to the dog and it could eat it. And we were able to reignite that pathway a little bit. But again, exactly as you pointed out before, like probably never got the dog to what it could have been had it had not been inhibited in the first place. But I guess that's like testing a match. It's one of those things that you never really know how far along you can get a dog compared to a different version of the same dog given, you know, different circumstances in the past.
I don't know if you remember in the very early days of you and me training in the shed, Paul brought his Roddy in. The way that we got that dog biting a wedge was putting a balloon inside it, like letting the dog see that we had a little inflated balloon.
How could I forget?
To bite the wedge.
The amount of running around in that fucking shed with balloons to try and get that dog interested.
It worked. It got the dog on it. But the thing is, I think that's what I relate to, that diffusal of a lack of understanding or an inability to really connect the dots in an efficient or an expected way. There have been some remarkable dogs that have defied the odds. I've seen dogs before that I've looked at them in the early days and people have come to me and said, what do you think? Like I've rescued this dog or I've got this dog late in life. There seems to be some issues. The bloodline of the dog is good. The siblings of the dog are quite good. This dog is not. You said before, which I totally agree, some people and some dogs are just not gifted and talented in certain areas. It doesn't mean they're not gifted and talented in other areas. I've known some dogs in bloodlines of good biting bloodlines that have never been really good at the biting side of it, but then they've gone off to do detection and they've been absolutely fantastic dogs in that because they can redirect it into a talent or a skill elsewhere where they have sufficiencies and they have capabilities in doing it. It doesn't mean that's the end of a working career for a dog. It just means that you have to rethink the strategy of a working career and what that looks like. But a biting career, I mean, there's just some dogs that aren't really capable of doing it. It's like some kids are academic. They don't like the idea of doing sports and being pushed into a sporting role is like their worst nightmare. It's the most aversive thing that you can do to them. They're not athletic. They don't dream of it. They don't desire it. It's a parent wanting to live through their child. So they pursue and push their child into it and say, this is what I want you to do. I want you to do this. And people do this with puppies when they get them. They think, I want to get involved in a dog sport of some kind. Doesn't matter what it is, insert title here. But they get a dog, they think, you're it. You're my dog. You're going to do this sport. And then they are heartbroken to find out the dog doesn't want to do it or the dog has an incapability of doing it. Now, that might be because genetics has played a large part in preventing the dog from doing it, or it could be somehow that the dog has been suppressed or educated not to do that along the way. An example of that, which I wrote down in my notes as I was listening to you talking, there have been a lot of dogs in detection roles before that started off life being told not to sniff. Like they've been punished for doing it. They've had, you know, like a kick in the face or a correction or a pull on the lead or something like that when they've been sniffing at things along the ground. They've been told, don't do this. Don't do your most powerful innate capability. Don't do it. I don't like it. It's annoying me. It's frustrating me. Stop doing it. So along the way, the dog's thinking, well, it's aversive to smell around you. I will do it when I'm not with you. It's like we talked about coprophagia in the last episode. Mate, let me tell you, there's been so many people coming out of the closet talking to me about how their dogs eat shit, but they don't like acknowledging it. It's more common than what people realize. As I said before, Ladybug's a shit eater, but she won't do it around us because she gets punished for doing it. We try to stop her as much as we possibly can, and so do a lot of other people. We suppress the urge in the dogs to do that. So when we talk about suppression in behaviors, they're things that I'm trying to suppress. I'm trying to reduce the amount of times that she wants to eat her own shit, but she has a strong innate desire to want to actually do it. Now, some people say it could be through dietary complications. There could be something missing in the diet, but for some dogs, they're born with it and they pass it on. It's hereditary. You know, like I said, Pixel does it. She's Ladybug's daughter. She is doing it herself. And I'm sure if I reach out to the siblings of Ladybug, I'll find that there is a smattering of dogs that have passed on that shit-eating gene. In fact, it's very common for a lot of French bulldogs. A lot of French bulldog people say to me, my dog does it too. You know, it's a frustrating thing, especially when they're indoor dogs, especially when they've just eaten a big shit pie and then they come over and want to kiss you. And that's horrifying and disgusting for people, which is why we want to talk about suppression. However, getting back to the point before where I was talking about dogs that are doing bite sports or dogs that are doing detection sports or detection games or detection requirements or something like that, you really got to come to the conclusion, like, is this strong enough now, the capability in this dog? If it was there genetically but it's been suppressed through time, am I going to get enough reemergence for this to be useful in what I'm doing? And you really have to come to terms with that after a period of time, because there's plenty of dogs, you and I both know this, through dog sports. And certainly, you know, like I've had a more lengthier career with it, with doing Schutzen in the early years and then getting into a few different sports and then now into PSA. There's dogs even now when I judge, or there's dogs now that I just look at and I think maybe a PDC, but that's it, or a PSA 1, but no further, because the dog just doesn't have the nerve or the capability to do it. And that's fine for some people. They're quite happy the fact that their dog can participate and be a part of the club and get a part of the journey through. But there's also dogs that won't make it past the entry. For them, it's like that example I used before of a child who is an academic rather than a gifted sports person. There are dogs that come in and think, I don't like this. I don't like being confronted with a person waving a thing around in front of me. You know, I'd rather sniff the ground, or I'm actually stressed about this. When the dog feels a bit conflicted about its emotions and how it feels about the situation, so they just basically give up on it. When I see that, and when I'm working with anybody, professionals, handlers, whatever it is, the question I ask them is, when you look at this, what do you see in this? Some people are inexperienced, they don't know what they're seeing, and they're very hopeful. Also, they've been given terrible advice from other people who also don't know what they're looking at, which I'm talking about other semi-industry professionals. And I'm saying the word semi because they're giving them terrible advice and leading them on to think that their dog has the capability and the potential to do so. Where I've had to break the bad news to people before in the past. I've had to tell people, your dog's a lovely dog, but it's not for this sport. Like, I can see it. There is a tell when I can see that a dog either doesn't have it as a genetic gift, or the dog has been so suppressed that the dog has basically given up its ability to do so. So while some dogs can be turned back on and that switch can be reignited and the flame can be re-kicked off, there are also dogs that, while the flame might be ignited, as I said before, there's a ceiling on that. And that may have been considerably reduced, and we just have to get real about those situations sometimes. If it's a sporting career that people want to look like, there are plenty of times where the advice has been, you need a second dog. That's the advice that I need to tell them, is that you need a second dog. This dog is just not capable of doing that work. And trying to push this dog through it will be quite a frustrating experience for both you and the dog. And I feel that it will be more detrimental to the relationship you've got going forward than it will building one.
I think as well, just to sort of round out Gavin's question, is I think a lot of the time with dogs out of rescue, they've been so suppressed, however it came to be, that they don't want to play. And I think that the ability to play really relies on an element of safety.
Mm.
And so I think sometimes we can, you know, I certainly have been guilty of it in the past, and I see people, you know, now doing it, is that you might try and, you know, engage in a game or solicit a tug game or something like that with a dog at a time where the dog just isn't going to be capable of any kind of game, let alone one that involves a level of commitment and using its mouth in a way like that. So, like, I think sometimes we sort of take for granted that even if a dog isn't very unlikely to bite you, having nothing in its mouth and having the ability to do that can be quite important to a dog. Like, just at least thinking, well, like, I have the ability to bite my way out of this situation if I need to. The chances of them engaging in a game of tug at a time where they're also thinking, I might have to bite my way out of here, as zero. Like, you can't get those two things. They're not going to coalesce, because if he's thinking I need to fight, he's not going to be able to play in that moment. Especially, you know, like, if we're not talking about a working dog, we're just talking about a random pet dog.
Mm.
So I think creating an element of safety is very important. And I think sometimes in order to be able to develop back to the point where a dog actually will play with toys, can have an element of playing with food first, where just getting the idea of just, hey, in this environment, just play. And that might look like, you know, just throwing the food and having the dog chase it, or having the dog, you know, just pursue the food a little bit, like, you know, lean into my hand as I do it, push me around a little bit as I'm offering you the food, follow a lure, chase it. Even one of the things I find myself doing with the dogs that have really been kind of shut down a fair bit and they don't really want to play is even just throwing food to them. Like, you know, giving a marker and popping a piece of food in the air and having it snatch it out of the air.
Mm.
Like, all of those things are going to be steps towards getting the dog to, like, be so comfortable that it will take those risks.
Yep.
And I think as well, like, if the dog's actually been inhibited, like, if there's an inhibition there, you know, via suppression, that's a choice. Once a behavior or neural pathway has been suppressed, the dog then is making the choice of, like, well, I'm not going to do the thing that I want because I am avoiding the consequence that could come. As I said, you've got to sort of convince the dog to either accept the consequence and then not have it happen, or also convince it, like, there won't be a consequence for this. And you have to show them that via sort of circling around the thing that is causing the aversion or the avoidance. And so I think it really depends. Is the reason this dog isn't showing me as much drive as I want, is that because it just isn't there in the dog and I got to cultivate it a little bit and see how much more I can get from the dog and teach the dog to enjoy challenges and pursuit and stuff like that, versus, is there an inhibition? Like, is the dog got something that it's choosing not to do because it's afraid of the consequence? And then I have to either make it no longer afraid of the consequence or understand that there won't be a consequence. And so while they're fairly similar sort of fixes, they are a little bit different in terms of what you're going to do. But I think one thing to remember always is that gameplay is gameplay. So whether you can get it in a tug and you're playing a really rambunctious game of tug where the dog's hanging on for dear life and you're able to swing the tug around, and or versus having the dog catch a piece of food out of the air and then turn around and quickly catch another one, you know, like, all of those are making progress no matter which one you can do, and one, you know, will enable the other. So any amount of time spent where the dog is thinking, geez, I'm having fun and I'm not afraid of anything going wrong here, and I'm playing a game with this person, no matter what the game is, all of that is going to assist in the progress forward, even if the inhibition is actually on putting its teeth onto something. If that was what was caused by accident or, you know, on purpose to a young dog, any amount of time spent in the pursuit, in the mindset of play, is going to assist in progress with the ultimate thing that we want, which may not look like what you're doing right now. So I think that's the sort of trick, is just getting the dog to lose itself a little bit and forget, you know, like, that it was ever inhibited, and actually just enjoy itself in the session.
Just as an insert there, and just thinking out loud, I was actually thinking and discussing this the other day. The only issue that I see in similar incidences to that is, rather than the dog be in a comfortable predatory state of mind, the dog always has a residual of avoidance and defense in those sort of situations. And that's the sting that comes with that when there's damage. Because the event that a child or a puppy experiences can have a life-altering effect into their adulthood. Like, I know people, even myself, there are things that have been said to me as a child that have affected me into adulthood. Things that I wasn't aware that I had issues with, or inhibitions, or even suppression with, over comments that were said to me as a child. There was a comment said to a friend of mine by his dad when they were changing in a change room one time, you know, like, I think he said, oh, you got a little willy or something like that. And for him, for the rest of his life, he could never change in a change room in front of people because of that comment that his dad said. Like, it was just a joke, but it affected him long term for the rest of his life. Mm. It's remarkable how some of these things can have sometimes a single event learning experience, which will it will haunt you throughout the rest of your life. Getting back to the original point that I was making is when a dog, as we're talking about dogs, when a dog is very comfortable in that play, that predatory state of mind, as you said, they lose themselves in the behavior. They're highly aroused. They're very comfortable with what they're doing. But if it's been built and it's been remanufactured and it's been reestablished, you're trying to ignite it again. The problem is not always, but sometimes you're dealing, and you don't know this until you know it, you're dealing with a mind that's diffused. It's not clear as what we would like it to be. We don't have that single lane of learning going backwards and forwards. We have a mind that's fractured, diffused. It does understand that this is good, but the problem with a defensive mindset is, and at the back of defense, pushing defense is the ability to avoid. Defense is thinly veiled avoidance. It's like a constant relationship with each other. And that's the problem that I see in those sort of situations is it's fun while it's fun and you haven't pushed too far. It's like single-sided toilet paper. You can break it and go through it so easy. you just have to be so careful in those sort of situations. This is where talent comes through, and this really is where that old adage that I've been quoting for most of my life is no more, one more time. Like, you've got to be so mindful and so careful because you're dealing with a student that doesn't know what they don't know at that point in time, and it's your cultivating that's carefully growing this. If there's no real long-term damage or there's no real problem within the dog and you're a talented trainer and you've got a really good handler and you're both abiding by those rules – as you said before, Pat, you can get the dog through this and you can make some amazing progress where you can think to yourself, like, this is incredible. We've started with nothing here. We've started with a slate where the dog is basically just standing there looking at me and avoiding any desire or want to play. And now 6 months later down the track, we've got a dog who's actively pursuing, biting, tugging, re-gripping into flirt poles, into wedges, into puppy sleeves, into Belgium sleeves, and hopefully onto a sleeve or onto a suit, you know, like if we can build that progression. But we also got to be aware that can be anomalous too. Like, sometimes it's like pissing into the wind. We just don't know what it's going to look like until the progression of the story is revealed to us based on the capability and the mindset of the student.
For sure. Let's move on. Charlotte Mirth says, I wouldn't mind a discussion on something that I've unfortunately heard from some trainers who will swear up and down their dog knows a command, like change of positions, and the dog consistently has mistakes when you give a command, like sits when you ask for a stand or down when asking for a sit. I adopted a dog with some training, and the original trainer swore the dog was being stubborn and knew things. I trained with the same trainer for the first year, and now that I've distanced myself, I'm finding that the dog seems to be a decent guesser. I've redone a lot and given behaviors new names. I'm also training with a mirror and eliminating unintentional cues. All have helped. But as I've worked with her, I feel like half the training has been teaching her to stop guessing and to listen and think. I would enjoy hearing y'all's experiences and also maybe ways to identify if a dog is just decent at guessing versus actually knowing the command early on. I wish I would have listened to my gut earlier on with my dog. The really interesting thing of this is an interesting conversation around shaping and stuff like that, right? Mm. So, like, for sure, there's elements that you get from shaping a dog that are super beneficial for the dog. While we, you know, certainly I have been this really strong advocate of shaping, I think that there's a lot of benefits that can come of it. I think that there's also a lot of risks that sometimes don't get talked about anywhere near as much as they need to. And I think one of those things is sometimes via shaping, we can end up creating something of a frantic dog. And I think it depends on how people are doing their shaping, as well as the context in which it's being done, but also the feedback that's being given to the dog. And I think that when you are leaving a dog with too much freedom in the shaping, i.e. you're only ever telling it when it's right and you're not giving it feedback that it's wrong at any point, which is tricky to do when you're shaping, is that I think that sometimes you can get a dogs that will cycle through various behaviors and sort of just keep offering things until they offer you something that you like. And so for me, while I still do shaping with dogs and I recommend that people do, and certainly having my own dog who I free shaped everything with as a bit of an experiment, there's some cons that come of that. And I've watched and I've seen a lot of people around the world now that I've sort of seen develop their dogs in various styles. And I watch their training online and I see their videos and stuff like that, as well as train with them in person sometimes. I see an element of franticness that comes from when there is too much shaping and there's not enough information about when you're wrong and only information about when you're right. I think similarly, sometimes when naming behaviors, people don't pay enough attention to the behavior, that new signal being the key signal that the dog needs to actually perform the task. Whereas I think what I've observed, and certainly, again, you know, I've been guilty of doing this, it's how I know for sure that it happens, is that sometimes what people think is the name of the behavior is actually just a trigger to the dog to perform an action, whatever it feels like is correct. And the context under which the training is being done will inform the dog as to what's likely to be correct. So, you know, we imagine that you, when you tell the dog to sit, a dog understands, yep, I know that means to put my ass on the floor, stay where I am, right? And whatever extra criteria of the sit that there is. Mm. But in fact, what is sometimes heard from the dog is that the dog looks around and goes, right, well, I see the position board here. I see you standing there in the posture from which you deliver commands. And I hear the word sit, you for sure want something from me. Let me go to that position box and do the thing that has brought me success in the past. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that the dog even understands a sit, because it might have, you know, depending on what other behaviors you've been training and where you're at with your, you know, reinforcement of those behaviors and what you did in the last session that looks similar to this one to the dog, all of that's going to come into effect where the dog goes, okay, this is what I think you want from me. And it's not necessarily that the command to sit tells the dog to sit. It just tells it that the window of opportunity to do something in order to earn some sort of prize is available. Now take a guess at what that thing's going to be in order to earn that prize. And as we become more precise, like that's how training works, right? This is happening whether you like acknowledge that or not. That's what happens. And now we want the precision with which we ask the dog to do this and the other information that's available to the dog to take in to figure out what it is to all be narrowed down so the dog actually understands, oh, okay, this is a sit. Like when you say sit, it's that you want my ass to hit the floor, not that I should do the thing that I think will lead to success, you know, noting what happened last time and what equipment is out here. Like there's an actual strong understanding of the behavior. So I think that is very common, that a lot of dogs don't really know necessarily what's being asked of them specifically.
Yeah.
They just know how to read the play and go, well, this is probably what you're asking for. And that command that you're saying, like what we think is the telling the dog to do the behavior, actually tells the dog like do our behavior, but not necessarily the specific one that we want. I think this is the role of negative reinforcement as feedback into behaviors. So this is why, you know, I still very much enjoy the learning process of teaching things as much as possible with positive reinforcement,
yep,
but then creating a learning phase of negative reinforcement into all of these behaviors in order to assist the dog and tell it what it's not. Because I think that's the sort of biggest value that we have in the learning phase of using negative reinforcement, is that we can help a dog understand not just what it is, because negative, like positive reinforcement says, hey, right then you were correct. You no longer need to do the behavior if we're terminally, you know, marking the dog out of the behavior. But with negative reinforcement, we can help the dog into the behavior. And in our example of, you know, if we tell a dog to sit and it downs, and then we go over to give it help and it goes into the sit and then you pay it, you know, if that help was positive reinforcement based, the only chance that the dog will avoid that help in the future is for efficiency's sake. But so when, if the dog now thinks you say sit, I go into a down, you walk over, lure me up into a sit, I go into a sit and then I get the food. The only reason the dog's going to go into a sit next time is because he goes, well, let's just get to the end of this behavioral chain, because we don't need to go through the whole sequence of events of me going into a down, you assisting me into the sit. But it's possible as well that the dog goes, no, well, that's the sequence. Like that's what we're doing. That's the dance that we do. So I just offer a random behavior. You help me into that behavior. So the help in that instance is better done in a way of being a type of help that the dog wants to escape and avoid in the future. You know, and when we're talking sort of, you know, leash pressure here, just helping the dog into the correct behavior. So you can tell the dog, hey, it's not a down. And instead of appetitively helping you into the sit in a way where you're happy for it to happen, I'll do it with a minor level of aversion, i.e., you know, just collar pressure, lifting the dog into the behavior where the dog goes, oh, you know what? I'd rather avoid that in the future. So when you say sit, I'll do the thing that where like the positive reinforcement comes from without any of the extra help along the way, because I just want to get to the end point and I also want to avoid the help. But if there's no reason to avoid the help, then we're relying on the fact that the dog avoids the help for efficiency's sake. And that may not always be the case. Some dogs, especially if they're not especially, you know, interested in thinking, or they're not a dog that is hyper into solving the puzzle and they're happy just to be put where you need to put them, then they never will really solve that problem. And some dogs are like that. You know, some dogs, they never shorten behavioral chains because they're like, no, we'll just go through the whole sequence. I'm not that pumped about it. And especially if there's, you know, spatial pressure or like luring involved in helping the dog understand it, if the dog is like enjoys the process of getting help into the behavior, it may never choose to avoid that help and just wait for you to do it as well. I think the other thing to keep in mind for sure, in line with what Charlotte has said here, is really truly understanding the sequencing for classical conditioning into naming behaviors. And I think that many people have some sort of like gestural cue that brings on the behavior because, you know, if you haven't named a behavior, but you can make it happen in a way where you go, okay, well, I'm ready to name the behavior, right? Like, because we always say, don't name it till you love it. There's all these various things. But if you can get the behavior to happen, then it has some sort of signal. The dog is perceiving some sort of signal that initiates the behavior. And chances are that's your posture or something like that. If you create an overshadowing effect via luring the dog at the same time as giving the command, the dog's never going to hear the command. He's going to hear it, but he's not going to take it as information that triggers something to happen because that is already set into motion. You're just giving commentary as to what's happening while it's happening, not setting it into motion, which is the role of classical conditioning. So I think very often when dogs don't display the correct behavior when they're asked, and the learning has been good, you know, like they've taught the dog in a way that the dog should understand, it probably is just a sequencing error and that the dog is not displaying the behavior correctly because it doesn't understand the name of the behavior to mean do the thing. Again, they probably just understand you speaking sets them into work and then they should just read the play and choose what it is that they think will lead to success. The last thing I'll say on it, you know, one of the things that Bart always says when you're doing the shaping games and stuff like that is that you never know whether a dog actually knows what you're asking it to do until you first set up the context where it looks like you're asking it to do something else and ask it to do, like you set up the context to look to the dog like this is behavior B. And then you ask it to do behavior A. So now we know, okay, he's not just reading the play, he's listening to what you said because he does the thing that you've said. And then the other way to it, you know, be sure that the dog actually understands the command is to tell the dog to do one thing. And while it's on its way to doing that one thing, tell it to do another. So like if you send the dog out to, you know, to go to a marker board or something like that, and on its way out to go to the marker board, you can then tell it to down. Well, we know for sure now that dog understands the down, right? Because it like the new command takes the precedence over the old command and makes the old command no longer, doesn't have to be followed through. It has to do the new one. So when you can do that with a dog, that's another diagnosis of the fact that like, yes, for sure, this dog understands what I'm asking for because I can tell it to do one thing, given the context looking another way. And then I can change my mind about what I want it to do and it will do the thing that I've said. So now I truly understand the dog understands my commands and is following through the behaviors with that minimal signal, like the minimal gesture that you know, we want to reduce down to being nothing but our voice for most commands.
Mm. I agree with everything you said there. I think you made a really good set of points for why a lot of those issues arise and why we have conflict as a handler and a dog. Also with the training team, there are incredible amounts of misinformation that's being passed between that triad on a regular basis. On the flip side of that, when it's done well, there's a lot of good information that's been passed along those lines. And that's why the dog develops a system of clarity in what it's supposed to do because it has a perception of it. And it's incredible what perception actually does. It's incredible what you perceive when somebody tells you something And when you can see that done well, when you've got alignment between two people, like this is what I meant and this is what you understood and it's aligned, that means that you have educated that student correctly. You have given them an image and they have also seen the image of that in their mind's eye. When you were talking about this before with Bart's example, there was a test that was going around on social media a while ago where they would have the color blue written in red and they would say, say the color that you see. And because it said blue, people would say blue, but that's not what it was. It was red. It's the color that you see. But that is your perception of it at the time because you've not read the question correctly or that's how you've perceived the question to be. I often see when I see dogs making decisions like this where they have a perception of what they should be doing, there could be a variation of why that could happen. There's been a lot of times where I've been watching trials and more recently where I've been judging trials where I know that a dog has prior learning. I know that a dog has good experience. I also know that a dog has titles in different things. But when the field is set up differently and that dog is switching from a classical mindset back into an operant mindset, you can see the challenge immediately reside within the dog. Like, I don't understand how to complete the picture in this. It's fragmenting or it's diffusing my understanding of this situation. It also shows me that the dog and the team haven't developed somewhat of a generalization in the mindset of what actually needs to be done. So we're competing against a couple of different variations here. Once again, we've got a dog that's operant mindsetted rather than developing a classical generalized mindset where the dog knows doesn't matter where I go or where I am or who I'm with or what is presented to me. When this word is given to me, it correlates to this behavior. There's no thinking that needs to be done because I've transitioned through the entire program of being shaped into the behavior and inserting there what you said before, Pat, about people creating a frantic dog with their shaping program. I've done that before where I've thought I've shaped too many things too frequently with the dog because I'm enjoying myself, but I haven't realized the perception of my student here, in that case, the dog. I've been on a mindset where I've ignored my own advice, too much training. I've gone past the rule of no more, one more time. I've kept pushing. I'm making so many criteria so closely attached to each other that I also forget that dogs also like to chain things together. So there are periods where, although I think I'm shaping individual criteria, I've done them so closely together that the dog thought, oh, these two things are attributed. Therefore, I'm going to route them into a behavior sequence together. And therefore, you've got a problem with that itself. There are often times where I've also noted that dogs will link punishment into a behavior in order to get reinforcement. So they will do a behavior, they'll be punished for it, then they'll be asked to do another behavior, they'll do that and they'll be reinforced together. So what happens is the dog sees this event and thinks the way to successfully complete this behavior is through punishment. I have to do the wrong thing first, be punished, and then I'll be reinforced. That's if the sequence is repeated frequently enough. It's also, again, perception of the student as well. Like if the dog perceives that as this is part of my lifestyle, this is how I learn to do things, this is how the relationship between me and the handler works, you can create some of these most anomalous things that happens with dogs. And then you're confronted with confusing variations in obedience because it just hasn't been programmed well enough into the dog. You haven't set up the scenario where you've limited the amount of confusion. You've created more confusion than what you set out to do. Often with these sort of things, a simplified mindset needs to be done. I mean, it doesn't mean that dogs can't advance onto more complex learning and they can't successfully shape and chain things well together. But if you're fragmented and you're all over the place, or you've got a dog that you've rescued, for example, that's had a myriad of different educators and teachers along their programming pathway, especially while they're in a critical period of development and they're young and juvenile, then also you're dealing with something that's quite new and unexpected, and you're also dealing with a lot of junk information that's being programmed into your dog. So it's basically like being given a rope with a bunch of knots in it, and then you've got to undo all the knots in it to make the rope useful again. And that's what happens sometimes with the programming that our dogs are preconditioned with. To simplify that, my mindset now is often you need to begin with operant conditioning in everything that you're doing. You need to transpose into a classical mindset so the dog doesn't question the command anymore. It knows how to do it. And then all that needs to be generalized. So the dog needs to understand that not only do I need to not think about this, it's pre-programmed, it's autopilot, but I also need to perform it on any given scenario that I'm in. A good example is when I was in Vietnam and I was talking about a dog before. One of the dogs who is a very good dog and it's been titled in IGP. The dog is fantastic. Handler is fantastic. The dog and handler duo are very good together. However, PSA presents a lot of dilemmas for some of those dogs sometimes because they've seen a system. They've been working in a pattern where PSA throws chaos into order. And that dog, when it came onto the PSA 1 field and it saw all these distractions around, even though this dog had great conditioning and the dog was doing some beautiful work, as soon as that process was displayed to the dog, the mindset of the dog shifted immediately. And I could tell straight away that that dog didn't have generalization under those conditions because under the conditions of all the distractions, the dog couldn't compete with that. It was just simply hunting balls and hunting toys on the field, it just didn't know what it was supposed to do. That's revealing, and that's a good and a bad thing. It wasn't good for the handler. He didn't enjoy the fact that his dog was giving away points every time he was trying to walk down the field and the dog was trying to hunt toys and had to be corrected or pulled off the situation. Going into that, now the handler understands I've got a picture of what needs to be done. Now I can reprogram my dog into what a PSA field demands now that I'm actually going into those sort of titles. There's a range of different reasons. I think you would probably explain with a lot more clarity than what I did. However, that's the issue that I see in those sort of situations. So yeah, once again, to summarize it, with myself, with what I'm doing now these days is I like to help my dog to understand what it is and where it is and how it is in any given situation. And then I like to, as much as possible, transpose it from an operant mindset into a classical mindset with as much generalization as I possibly can. Therefore, when I'm in a situation where I'm feeling stressed and the dog is feeling stressed, the dog still doesn't need to compete with thinking too much about the position it's being told to do. It just understands this is what I need to do and this is how I do it.
Mm. I think as well, you know, what like we take for granted sometimes when people are training their dog, sometimes a dog makes anticipatory moves, right? And
yes.
It was what we were planning for them to do. And a lot of people then are like, the dog's predicting it and they pay the dog. And anticipation is one of those really tricky things where you know it's got to happen, right? Like that shows learning. That's the dog putting the sequence together. I want a dog to anticipate and do something before I ask for it to happen because that tells me the dog like has figured out the pattern, but it also tells me that I've set a pattern that I now need to make sure that I need to break, right?
Yeah, the randomization never really came into question.
Yeah, and so I think no matter what technique you use, if you're consistent, the dog will figure it out, right? Like that's the truth of dog training as well, is that dogs are so good at figuring out what we want. If you're consistent, the dog will figure it out. But I think so often we give confusing signals to the dog. And sometimes we're happy when the dog anticipates because it was convenient for us versus the dog doing what it actually was meant to do. And we hadn't yet given the command and the dog stayed in the position. Like there's lots of different things where we give inconsistent signaling to the dogs. And the last thing that I think is really important and what I see a lot of the time when people are asking their dog to do something and the dog either doesn't do it or does something else, but confidently, right? Like, so the dog's not disobeying, it's doing what it thinks is the right thing to do in that moment, is that there's almost always some sort of misperceived signal from the dog. And I think we not enough take into account, you know, the hierarchy of signals where any sort of tactile cue, something the dog can feel, is going to have a lot of importance to the dog. And then our body language, and then finally our actual verbal commands. So there's so many different pieces of information that the dog's taking in and that the dog potentially feels is more important than the verbal command, that all those signals have to be gone in order for the dog even to be able to hear the verbal command, let alone put it in the correct location and sequence where it becomes the command itself. That's one of the things I see quite a bit. And, you know, I use the same example all the time. Like most dogs, especially not just dogs that have done bite work, but dogs that have been taught to drag into a collar to get a ball or something like that. So like if you've played rambunctiously with a dog and you've tried to resist it from getting a hold of something and held, you know, whether it's been on a back tie or you've let it drag you into something on the ground, that kind of stuff, then your tension on that flat collar is going to be an activating cue. And so you sometimes see the dog will be in a down on the ground and maybe people go to put some pressure, like to act as negative reinforcement into the behavior, and the dog breaks the behavior. Mm. Or they accidentally just put tension on the collar and the dog breaks the behavior immediately because, and then now we're correcting the dog and, you know, telling it it's wrong and all this kind of shit. But the truth is the dog was just acting on the signal because tension on that collar has meant reinforcement in the past. And that may as well be a clicker to the dog. If you pull on the flat collar, then that means like a terminal release and you go get your reinforcer. Where that becomes really tricky then is when people don't acknowledge that as being a fault of theirs and a miscommunication with the dog. So the dog thinks it's doing the right thing. And then you correct the dog in a way that now the dog perceives that as really unfair. And so what you think is a fair correction, the dog thinks is a very unfair correction, will cause a lot of conflict in the training and therefore make it harder to even progress and fix these sorts of issues. So again, I think with all of these things where the dog is doing, performing powerfully and confidently the wrong thing, I think that's a time where you do need to be very careful and be aware of like, hey, I want to try and take your point of view. You know, that's what I want to do with the dog in those moments is really try hard to take the dog's point of view and go, why are you doing that? Like, how are you perceiving this as being in your interest and progressing you towards success? How do I convince you that it's not in a way that you're going to understand and find fair? And I think that's what's really important when you're fixing these kinds of things, because if a dog's powerfully and confidently doing the wrong thing, you want to maintain that power and you want to maintain that confidence. You just want to help communicate to the dog what it is you actually want. And I think that's why we have to think of when you talk being operant, using negative reinforcement, using positive reinforcement, using punishment. I think using those things as a means of communication, rather than just looking at those as motivators, like why does a dog do anything? Because it's motivated towards or away things, stuff like that, is then looking, okay, like I know how the dog is motivated by pressure. I know how the dog is motivated by positive reinforcement. I understand these things. Now, how do I use those in order to turn them into communication? And noting that anything that's reinforcement is telling the dog, hey, I like that, do more of it. And anything that's punishment is telling the dog, hey, I don't like that, don't do that again, right? Or, you know, you can go negative reinforcement, hey, I need you to do this now versus, hey, I liked it when you did do that. And thinking of it in terms of communication with the dog like that, you're actually saying those things to the dog via the actions of giving that feedback is how you can communicate with the dog as to what you want, and really looking at it in terms of communication, like it's a conversation that's happening between you and the dog. I think similarly, the last thing I'll say on it is I think a lot of that work is best done outside of the behaviors. So I had some people in here the other day working on an out, and the way that I'm working on the out with this dog is really away from the context of how it will be used. Like I'm just teaching the dog, you know, I posted a video the other day as well of me just running away from a puppy, right? And running away while it has a toy, because I'm just trying to show it like, hey, want to give me things. So while he's pursuing me in order to restart the game, he's pursuing me to give me the item. And that's a big step in teaching that dog to out and showing the dog like, hey, I like it when you have the thing. And if you want to re-engage with me, you giving it back to me, like those are the sort of really foundational things that lead to the dog having strong understandings of behavior rather than, you know, risking conflict coming in over the dog thinking, misunderstanding what it is you want from them. So when you're telling a dog to down, if the dog thinks, well, oh, well, this is you sort of locking me in position and not allowing me to progress versus thinking that when I'm told to down, this is a coiling of the spring and I'm going to get to do something amazing out of this position. The behavior is the same, but how the dog thinks about it and therefore the way that you're communicating and the likelihood of the dog doing it and choosing to do it powerfully, those are quite different depending on the outcome of how you teach it. All of that put together is going to result in a dog that not only is looking for clear cues, understands what you give, but is also happy to do it, like finds it in their interest and is like, oh, well, this is fun. This is progressing me towards my ultimate goal, whatever that is.
Nicely said, sir. And I know that you're a big advocate for clarity, which is something that all of us are working towards with what we're trying to do. Because, yeah, so many of these issues are arising from the information that we actually give to our students. As I said before, if they have a shared image in their mind's eye of what we've been trying to educate them with, then obviously we have done our jobs correctly. We've explained the task correctly to our student. That's generally where I find things go askew far too often. We probably aren't very patient in our teaching, or we're probably very convoluted in the message that we're trying to pass along without thinking about perception of the student. Like, how does this student learn? And what have I done that's prevented that Or what have I done that's shown promise with that? Like field note it, take notes about these sort of things. Just to randomly go back to what I was talking about before, the field reveals a lot about what a dog is thinking and what a dog understands. Because once all the tools come off and once the dog is out there, that reveals to you, because the dog is in a state of arousal, there's a lot of things going on that's competing with the control mechanisms and the education that you've given the dog, that will really reveal to you, what does my dog really understand at the end of the day? When I've untethered, when the umbilical cord has been removed, what does my dog really understand? There's been many times, even with people, when I've said to them, if your dog is in a state of arousal and you give your dog a simplified term of a behavior that it knows well, one of its mother behaviors, will the dog perform the behavior or will the dog ignore you? And that will give you a glimpse into the future of what your dog will do when it goes out into a trial field or so forth.
I reckon we got room for one more.
One more.
This one's from Maggie Hunter. It's an interesting one. What's your why? As in, when people ask you why you do what you do, what's been your answer and how has it changed over time? This can be in regards to training or podcasting or both. Why do you keep on keeping on even in the face of, well, everything? Maybe too heavy for an AMA, but hey, you asked.
It's a good question and it's a really fair question and it's a question that has come up frequently. If I answer that question as to the why of why am I involved in this industry, why am I here for so long, the simple answer is I love being around dogs. I really enjoy it. I love watching dogs do things. There are certain times where it rubs a bit thin, like seeing the same thing repeated over and over and over again. For example, there was a club member from our PSA club that said to me, sometimes you don't come in and sit down and hang out with all of us for long periods of time. For 30 years, I've been watching dogs do bite work with people for a long period of time. Sitting in the audience and sitting on a seat is not really a thrilling thing for me. So there are times where I'll come in for short periods of time, I do the training with my dog, and I might go off and do something productive that I need to do. It doesn't mean that I'm not interested. It doesn't mean that I don't like the cliff notes of how people are doing. It doesn't mean that from time to time I'm not watching their progress videos or something like that. It's just that it's not as alluring to me when I was learning and I was doing stuff. It doesn't mean that I can't learn. It doesn't mean that there aren't new things that are hanging on. It's just things change, like you develop calluses to sort of things after a period of time. Sometimes I find myself watching random things that dogs are doing that are not related to PSA or scent detection or anything. Like they'll be random behaviors. I think I don't really know anything about that. And I'll be consuming hours and hours and hours and hours of content on it. Sometimes I'll be watching dogs doing shape behaviors. Once again, I'll be consuming hours and hours and hours of it. The short answer to probably a long chain of things that I'm thinking in my head, yes, I love this industry. I love working with the dogs. I've made it clear before that I'm not so excited about some of the people in the industry. Some of the people in the industry ruin experiences for me and other people, and some of them enhance them. I've met some remarkable people in this industry who are family to me. They're some of the best, nicest, and most wonderful people that I could ever have the privilege of sharing sections of my life with. They make it worth the while. But I will say it's largely because of the dogs. I love being around dogs. There's something magical about the experiences of sharing my life with dogs.
For sure. I think for me, the why on getting into training was exactly that. I really enjoy the process of trying to get in a dog's head. You know, I really enjoy the animals. I enjoy spending time around them. And I guess it's a sort of control freak in me that there's an element that would have got this started. Like I like manipulating behavior. I enjoy doing it. You know, that's not something I'm going to shy away from admitting. Like I do enjoy the process of modifying behavior in animals and it's just fun to do. When I first started, you know, as I said earlier in the episode, like when I first started free shaping, I sort of got obsessed with it because I was like, oh, holy shit. I can see how Skinner and others kind of felt like drunk on power with the ability to manipulate behavior like that. So that, you know, for sure is a big element. But the next step and sort of the more ethereal answer to that is that I really like dogs, love dogs, and I enjoy the process of trying to think from their point of view.
Yeah.
The best way to do that, to assess your capability in doing that, is to attempt to communicate with them in a way that they will be able to perform a task that you ask of them and find it in their interest and do it powerfully. And if you can do that, then you have communicated with the dog. And in order to communicate with the dog, then you have you've met them where they are. And I think that's what I enjoy about the process of doing that. On a work level, like the reason why I do what I do is I love doing it. I'm super lucky. I was saying when I was in Canberra the other week, the reality of my situation is that, yes, this is my job. And yes, this is how I make money and I make a good living. But at the end of the day, and we've discussed it on the show, like if I suddenly didn't have to worry about money, not a lot would actually change in my life. Like I would still be doing all the things that I'm doing. I would just get to attend more events. Like I would get to spend more time as a student and a little bit less time as a teacher because I would not need to be worrying about income, but I would still be training with the same people, you know, like, and very often a lot of the, I'm very lucky the way that I've established my business. It means that I do get to train with people a lot that I don't have to charge because I, you know, I make my money through teaching mostly. And so there's various forms of ways that I sell my information, but it means that I can then train with people and not have to worry about the cost of that. And the way that I like to train very often means that it would be difficult to even figure out how to charge people, you know, and I really enjoy problem solving. So that's my greatest skill set with dogs. It's like, you know, if there's people way better than me, you need someone to teach you a precision heel. There's people way better than me to teach you that. I'm going to recommend you those people. If you come to me with a blank slate and say, I want to learn world champion level healing, I'm referring you on. Yep. But when you come to me and you go, hey, why is my dog doing this? Or I'm stuck in this loop and I can't figure it out. That's my bread and butter. That's what I really love. So my why on why I, you know, train and my way my business goes the way that it does is I really love training dogs and I've gotten pretty good at it to the point where I can help a lot of people with specific problems. That's my biggest skill set is people get in contact with me like, hey, why is this happening? I can probably figure out why and I can probably help you come up with a solution for it. And I love doing that. I find that, you know.
Yeah, that's fun. Unlocking the problem and giving resolve and showing a pathway to hope is
working through it.
Yeah. Amazing. It's amazing.
I had
someone
in here the other day and like, I won't go into detail, but has been unable to trial her dog because there's been a persistent problem with the dog. And when I found out about it, I was able to reach out and go, hey, I know how to fix that problem. Come to me now and we'll work through this and we'll get you on the trial field. So like, I love the opportunity to do that. And I think my why, so like, that's why I got into training. That's why I run my business the way that I do. And my why around the podcast is an extension of all of that is that we're limited by capacity, especially time is the greatest limiting factor that we all have, right? Like it's the only non-renewable resource that we absolutely are losing and there's nothing you can do about it. We're moving through time at the speed of light and there's no stopping it.
Yep.
But by doing the podcast, it allows me to scale my time. So I really enjoy helping people where I can. I enjoy the idea that I think that dog training and the information around it should be accessible to everybody. I think that the moment you say out loud, like I'm in this for the dogs, but you make your information that you know, is good and is relevant and you don't have that as a reasonably accessible to everybody, then you're not really in it for the dogs. You're in it for yourself. You're making money. And we all do have to make money. And you know, there's definitely, for those of us who are full-time professionals or professionals in any capacity in the dog industry, we have to charge. We have to make enough money to feed our families and make it viable and, you know, get what we are worth. But on the flip side, one of the reasons why I love doing the podcast is that it allows us to invest, you and I invest a few hours a week, you know, there's probably 5 hours a week or something that goes into this podcast, maybe more, of thinking about things to talk about, actually recording it, you're editing it, then, you know, like when it goes out, there's an investment in time, but that has a disproportionate return in what we can provide to others.
Yep.
And that's why I like doing the podcast in that, you know, still every week, you know, as is now, we find it hard to find recording times. We sometimes miss the odd week here and there, like, you know, and we're nearly 300 episodes into this. We're not as consistent as we once were or would like to be. That's just the reality of life. But the truth is there's still thousands of people listening that are getting value from it. And at least once a week, I still get an email or a text or something. And it's either somebody who has had their specific problem solved or their life improved in one way or another. You know, many and various things that people reach out to us about. And when you get those emails, those are the why. And like I've said in the past, I have a folder in my phone that's got, I don't even know how many pictures are in there now. There'd be hundreds of feedback is what it's called. And every time someone emails us or sends me a message or something, I screenshot that and I put it into that folder, and it's something that I can reflect on from time to time. And it is, it's not often, but there are times when I think, oh, fuck this. Like, what? I'm sick of this shit. And then you go back and read a few of those and suddenly you're completely invigorated again. And to the point where some of them have told us that the podcast has had life, like, you know, radically altered their life. And that might mean that made them happy at a time when they were not, or set them on a path that has changed their life for the better. Like simple things like that. We've convinced people to zig instead of zag at certain times, and they've been happy with the outcome of their zag. And they saw what would have happened if they'd zigged, and are thankful of us for that. So that's the why on the podcast. And I'm really happy with it. And life's great, you know, like not to brag, but life's pretty good. And so long as I keep pursuing the things that I enjoy, I'm confident I'll be able to keep it that way.
Yeah, I share a sentiment that you said before where you mentioned that if money wasn't an object, what would change? There wouldn't be a lot of changes other than I would never wake up to an alarm clock. I would just literally wake up whenever I felt like it. But what I would do is I would invest more time into improving the quality of the podcast. Like I'd probably see if I could make more time to organize interviews and even traveling and so forth like that if it was on the cards. Those sort of things I would, yeah. I have actually envisaged what would happen if suddenly money wasn't an object for me. The other thing would be that, you know, I'd probably do things like go to nationals every year without fail and travel around. And again, sharing parallels with what you were talking about, I'd love to be more of a student and just go and hang out with cool dog trainers around the world and see what they're doing and be a student of theirs and, you know, be a gopher, be the coffee boy and do all those sort of things. That would be fun. That sort of stuff would be fun, is just traveling around, not only in the United States, but also through Europe, and spend time on the road for a period of time and do fun stuff like that. That would be fun. I would love to do that sort of stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Probably that's a good place to wrap up this one.
It is.
Guys, that's it. Another episode, Canon Paradigm.
Almost 300. We did it. Almost 300.
Yeah. We're getting to 300. We're finding the time to do these. This is a definitely out of cycle recording. We're doing our best to bring these to you. We're trying to get through all these questions. There's some really good questions in that I still want to get through.
Yeah.
So we'll go to another one of these for sure when we're in person next week. What's important to know is that if you like the show, you should just like, rate, share, subscribe, do all that kind of thing.
So did you see those?
Tell a friend in real life.
I did see gold star comments that were posted. I put them up on Instagram the other day. Thank you.
Amazing.
Some really nice and valid feedback is coming back through. So thank you very much. I really appreciated getting that. It really made my day when I had the email, I opened it up and they were like cascading with glowing reviews. So really thank you for making the time.
Cascading. Perfect. Yeah. Get on that. You should. If you want to support the show, the best way to do that is to jump into Patreon. A few bucks a month gets you this giant backlog of information.
Yes.
We're constantly putting stuff in there whenever there's something good to put in there, as well as I go live, do a live stream once a month where you can ask questions and get answers in there. You can give us as much as you like through Patreon if you like, but you know, a few bucks a month would be wonderful. Another way you could support the show is to buy some cool merch. I love seeing people wearing our stuff. It's always awesome when we go to events and there's people wearing our t-shirts and our hoodies and stuff like that. So you can jump into spring. There's links in the show notes that will take you to that. You can get yourself a giant wall tapestry.
Do that. You aren't cool until you've got a giant tapestry.
Yeah, a giant flag in your training studio of our logo.
That says that's Canine Paradigm. Really yeah. It's also cool with those sort of things too when you're watching people walking down the street doing Instagram reels and they're wearing Canine Paradigm swag.
Yeah. For sure. It's awesome. All right. And if you want to get in contact with us, the best way to do that is to jump into our Facebook discussion group. You can group source some information in there. There's always good conversations happening there. I always try and stay up to date with what's happening in there. As well as if you want to get in touch with us individually, you could shoot us an email. We are info@thecanineparadigm.com. Love you all. Goodbye.
There we go. We've got a proper outro.